It's time for justice. Welcome to... It's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and online at www.rir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
I can't tell you how many times over the years I've had people ask me to affirm that at 14, the child's preference rules, and that is not the case in Virginia. The child's preference is one of 10 factors the court considers, and I've been involved in plenty of cases where the outcome of the case has been the exact opposite of what the child's preference was.
Family law attorney Sandra Bowen talks about how judges decide child custody cases and the 10 specific factors listed in the Code of Virginia, which are to be considered in determining child custody. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn why the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act needs to become permanent. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 239, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.rir.org. It is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Much of the response to the foreclosure crisis has understandably been focused on the needs of homeowners. However, according to Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, we must not ignore the critical issue of renters in foreclosure. Research indicates that approximately 40% of the families affected by foreclosure are renters. These families often have no idea that their landlord has fallen behind on mortgage payments and usually have continued to pay their rent even as their landlord has failed to pay the mortgage. Prior to the passage of the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, or PTFA, in May 2009, tenants often were required to move with as little as a few days' notice. The enactment of the PTFA was a major step forward in addressing the housing stability of renters after a foreclosure, as the law ensures that most tenants can stay in their home for the remainder of their lease or for at least 90 days post-foreclosure. However, if Congress does not take action to extend the law, the PTFA will expire on December 31, 2014. The Permanently Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, introduced by Congressman Ellison, would take two important steps to help renters affected by foreclosure upon their landlord. The legislation would make the tenant protections of the PTFA permanent by repealing the sunset provision in current law. Renters should be protected regardless of when a foreclosure takes place. The legislation also would create an enforcement mechanism by establishing a private right of action for tenants who have been wrongfully evicted in violation of the PTFA. Legal aid organizations across the country continue to report widespread instances of PTFA violations. The addition of a private right of action is important to ensure compliance with the law. According to the Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul, Minnesota, this law has worked well for many years. It provides peace of mind for tenants that the terms of their lease will be honored and they will have adequate time to find a new place to live when they are caught up in a foreclosure through no fault of their own. It is critical that Congress act now to ensure that renters, faced with foreclosure through no fault of their own, are insured a basic level of protection after a foreclosure occurs. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. The Code of Virginia lists 10 specific factors to be considered in determining child custody, but which are more important and which are less important? Family law attorney Sandra Bowen talks about how judges decide child custody cases in the second part of a two-part interview. How does a party in court, whether they have a lawyer or not, avoid the problem of the he said, she said, where this claim is made, the other party denies it, and the judge is left to scratch his or her head and try to figure out which party they believe most?
Well, unfortunately, too many times, a lot of what goes on inside a home or between parents who don't live together happens in private, and there really aren't any other witnesses to the interactions between the parents. And that aspect of a case is going to always revolve around a he says, she says. And that will be determined based on the credibility of the parties. I find that having folks prepared with those five important talking points enhances a pro se, what we call a self-represented litigant, become more credible in front of the court. You're organized, your information is organized. You want to avoid saying he always does this or she never does that. Never and always, courts hear those as exaggerations, which aren't credible. So as you are considering your circumstances, keep a diary. As you're considering the facts and circumstances of your case, keep a diary. You can keep notes in a spiral notebook. You can keep them on a calendar. But when you can come to court and say to the judge, well, I wrote down every time this happened, and you've got dates that you can give to the court, and you've got numbers that the judge can hear you talk about. If you're in a visitation situation and you have a series of months that might involve 12 visitation opportunities, and you can say to the judge, the other parent was on time three of those visitations, this kind of data is very helpful to support your credibility. This is, like I said, too many times it's just nothing but a he says, she says. But if there's anybody who sees you with your child, who knows your child, and who has opportunities to observe your child interacting with you, who can come to court and help the judge know better the nature of your relationship with your child, and also know better your child, bring them with you. If there's any way you can have a witness, bring the witness with you to court.
Now, in terms of witnesses, obviously judges don't want to hear what we as lawyers refer to as cumulative evidence. That is, one person after another, basically saying the same thing over and over. The judge has limited time. Judge has heard it once. The judge doesn't need to hear it three times. So how do you avoid that problem of the, quote, cumulative evidence?
Well, sometimes it's nothing more than letting the judge know that this person is out in the hall and willing to come in and talk to them. I find that if it's a family member, the judge is very interested in hearing from at least one family member. Bringing a whole posse of people isn't necessarily going to help your case. It's not going to make you more credible. And the judge is just going to see that in a way as just piling on. And they may, in fact, negatively affect your credibility. Because you're right, Marty, the judges don't want to hear the same story over and over again. They want relevant information. They want information that's going to help them decide the case. So as you look at your five most important talking points, if you've got somebody who can be present at exchanges to observe how they take place, that person can then come to court with you later to testify about the difficulties you might be experiencing at an exchange. You know, you can prepare ahead of time for going to court. If you see that something is difficult, some aspect of co-parenting or dealing with the other parent in the case, you can ask a friend or a neighbor or a family member to be a witness to these interactions so that they can come to court and say to the judge, I would tell you the same thing that the mother just told you about how difficult the exchange is. If you're the non-custodial parent, you should definitely look for opportunities to spend time with your child with some other people present so that these folks can potentially come with you to court in the future to talk about the way you interact with your child, the degree to which you're responsible for your child, and also tuned into what your child needs.
And what about paper records? Things like medical records, school records, even a police report if we've got a domestic violence situation. Are those useful? If so, how do you obtain them? And more importantly, how do you get them before the judge, especially if you are a pro se litigant representing yourself?
Well, I think that's one of the most challenging aspects of for a self-represented litigant is how to get appropriate documentation before the court to help them in the case. Of course, we're talking today about custody and visitation, but this comes up in child support cases very often. Bring your own records. All of your own records are admissible in court. So if you're keeping a calendar, if you're keeping a diary, if you might have a detail you can print off on your cell phone bill that might show the frequency and number of text messages, the frequency and number of telephone calls between you and the other parent, sometimes that can be helpful. I find that the judges are all willing and interested in looking at report cards. They're very happy to look at the report card. Otherwise, though, getting other types of academic records in, they've got to be relevant. Attendance records, how many times is a child late to school because the other parent is tardy getting them there. Those kinds of records, we're very lucky in Virginia because we do have a statute that says that these subpoenaed school records, when certified by the school authorities, are admissible without a school person being there as a witness to authenticate the document. So you should consider filling out what we call subpoena ducis tecum. It's D-U-C-E-S-T-E-C-U-M. They're available at the clerk's offices, and most clerk's offices have samples of how to fill them in. But you can have that issued for your child's school. You can address it to the school care of the principal or even the guidance counselor or any of the assistant principals, but you do need to put their name down so that the process server will serve it on a person at the school. The schools are very familiar with this statute. They'll make a copy of the school records. They'll put the proper authenticating affidavit with them and then have those records sent by the school to the courthouse so that they're there well ahead of the court case. And that way the court can look at that entire set of records. This would include all of the attendance records, days tardy, days absent, disciplinary records, academic records. Pretty much the only thing you're not going to get are the teacher's notes. Teacher's notes on homework, things like that. You're not going to get those. But that's something that can be admitted into evidence and could be very helpful to the court, for which you don't need to bring a witness. There are some medical records that can be introduced sometimes, but what we're talking about there is going to be copies of doctors' handwritten notes in a child's file. Often they're very difficult to understand. We find that's often a case with a counselor. Counselor notes, these people have notoriously bad handwriting, and they're also very limited notes, so they're not necessarily helpful. You can get records from the Division of Motor Vehicles. And the nice thing about the records from the Division of Motor Vehicles is, just like school records, They come with an authenticating affidavit, and you don't need a witness from DMV. So if you're aware of traffic convictions, drunk driving convictions, suspended driver's licenses, things like that that the other parent might have, certainly issue a subpoena to the Department of Motor Vehicles so that you can obtain copies of the other parent's driving record. You can simply ask for, it's called a driver's license transcript, and they will send you a record of the status of the driver's license. You can also ask for a copy of the driving record. It will show you convictions going back about 10 years. You can also get records from a daycare center, but for those, you're going to need to have a witness come to authenticate those records. But I find that often a judge will look at these records. They're subject to what we call the hearsay objection. That really impacts the credibility of the record. But the judges will look at these and they'll just say they're going to give them the appropriate weight. But again, it's got to be helpful to the judge, and that kind of depends on what your case is about. If you have somebody who can come to court but they need a witness subpoena in order to get off of work, again, you would do that at the clerk's office where your case is pending, and you want to have it served on your witness at their home. That's sufficient for them to give their work in order to get the time off that they need to come to court.
Now, turning back to the factors that the General Assembly has given the judges that they shall consider in custody cases, one of the ones that is listed and comes up a lot in people's minds is the reasonable preference of the child. How is that handled by the judge?
I'll tell you, Marty, that's a great question, and I can't tell you how many times over the years I've had people ask me to affirm that at 14 the child's preference rules, and that is not the case in Virginia. The child's preference is one of 10 factors the court considers, and I've been involved in plenty of cases where the outcome of the case has been the exact opposite of what the child's preference was. The judges are not going to be controlled by the preference of the child, mostly because there are so many circumstances that are relevant to the judge's decision that are really adult issues. The children don't have the maturity or even the intellectual capacity to be able to understand and integrate well. More often, they see a child who a parent insists on bringing to court to express a preference as somebody who's been coached inappropriately by a parent. It's a very difficult tightrope to walk, even for lawyers, to bring in the preference of the child as relevant for the court's consideration. I've had everybody from teenagers to elementary school-aged kids where parents have insisted that the child be made available to the judge to be interviewed or cross-examined, but I think largely the courts consider that to be very bad parenting if you're insisting on bringing your child to court. The rules say that the child has to sit in the witness box and is subject to being cross-examined by the attorneys. There's a little exception that will allow for the judge to interview the child in chambers, but it requires that the interview be transcribed by a court reporter. Now, that applies in the circuit court. In the juvenile court, we don't have rules that control how a court receives testimony from a child. No rules at all. And it's up to each judge how they handle that. Most of the judges around here, on the occasion where they will hear from a child, will talk to the child in chambers, as long as both parents agree that that's the appropriate way to go about the interview. Judges will tell lawyers candidly in settings like seminars or casual settings like bar gatherings that they never ask the child what they want to see happen. They ask the child more indirect questions. What do you like to do at your mom's house? What do you like to do at your dad's house? They'll ask a child about how circumstances make them feel. How does it make them feel when mom and dad argue in front of you? About visitation and about who gets to stand where at a school PTA performance of some sort.
And when these interviews do take place with the judge, in the judge's chambers, the judge's private office with the child, assuming both parents agree. Is it just the judge and the child? Are there lawyers back there who are sworn to secrecy as to what happens? And is there ever a guardian ad litem, the court-appointed lawyer to represent the best interests of the child back there, again, sworn to secrecy as to what happens in the judge's chambers?
Well, as I said, if the case is in the circuit court, then there are rules about how the child is interviewed by the judge and who can be present. However, in the juvenile court, we don't have any rules. It's up to each judge how they handle it. If there is a guardian ad litem appointed in your case, and that's a lawyer who's been appointed to represent your child as an attorney in the course of the proceedings, if there is a guardian ad litem, very often our juvenile courts, the judges will ask the guardian to come back into the chambers with the child, but for the most part, they're going to ask the lawyers representing the parties, or if there are no lawyers, the parties themselves, the parents, whether or not they agree to that. It's oftentimes a good idea to have the guardian go back with the child to the judge's chambers, because the guardian sometimes has some history and knows some information that the child might be reluctant to share, but with the guardian there, the child feels more courage and is willing to put the information out there, but might do it more completely with the guardian ad litem there assisting them. But we've recently had some interesting contests around here, at least what I hear from other lawyers, where the circuit court judges are claiming that they're governed by the rules about interviewing a child in chambers that's in the code. It's 20-124.2:1. But our juvenile court judges are saying this doesn't apply to us, and they're handling things very differently. And it varies from judge to judge as well.
So any closing thoughts on what people should do to prepare for a custody visitation case?
Well, writing down what you want to say, and not something that you would read, but just your talking points, I think is really important to help you present an organized case. You don't have a lot of time. A lot of times each party's got 30 minutes to put their whole case on and argue, and that's just not enough time to tell your life story. The other thing goes back to an early point I made, which is be prepared to tell the judge what you want the outcome to look like. Write down how you want the holidays to sound. Write down what you want the summer schedule to look like. If you've always got a family reunion around the fourth week of July, make sure the judge knows that you have a family reunion you go to the fourth week of July every year, and that's important to you that not be interrupted. The last thing you want is to go out of the door and say, oh, I forgot to tell the judge about this very important family tradition that we have regarding the holidays. You can even go down as detailed as how to do trick-or-treat on Halloween, if that's something that your family does. How to spend the 4th of July. In fact, I just represented a young couple. Part of what drove them to court to begin with on a modification was a big fight they had last summer about how they were going to split the 4th of July. The court order just said that the holidays would be shared, and they needed help. They needed a more detailed schedule. So the judge ordered that they would alternate the 4th of July from July 4th to the morning of July 5th. So it's fair to be detailed, to be able to write up something to the judge that says, this is what every other weekend should look like in our family. This is what the Christmas holidays should look like in our family. This is what we should do with spring break. Some parents only get 2 weeks of vacation a year, and they may always want to use that in the summer. So for them, they may not want time at spring break, but they may want time at Christmas because their company shuts down for a week over the holidays, for example. So if you get yourself organized ahead of time and you think through these details, it's even fair to take it to a family member of a friend and ask this person to look it over before you go to court. Does it make sense? Does it say what you want it to say? And with that, you should wind up with an outcome that pretty much matches what you wanted to see happen. And you might not be disappointed that often if you go in prepared.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Sandra Bowen. She's an attorney with the firm of Bowen, Tenn, and Cardani in the west end of Henrico County near Broad and Gaskins. And we have been talking about how courts decide what is in the best interest of children in child custody and visitation cases. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Marty.
You've been listening to family law attorney Sandra Bowen talking about how judges decide child custody cases in the second part of a two-part interview. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Once near extinction, bedbugs have returned with a vengeance, especially in rental housing and especially in Richmond. Join us next week when professional exterminator Craig Duncan gives expert inside advice about how to protect yourself from bedbugs and what to do if you find them in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on February 13, 2013. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wagner.